pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate. You're listening to news, views, and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business, and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, listeners, to the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove, episode 21. That was yet another magnificent introduction from Scott. Hello, Scott. Hope you're enjoying your holiday. And with me, of course, for the second week in a row, is the 12th man, Paul.
Hello, Trevor. How are you tonight?
I'm very well. As I said to you before, I was incandescent with rage, but I fired off a few emails and I feel a lot better now. But
oh, that's good.
Yeah.
We don't want you being continually cranky about anything.
That's right. So, Paul, since we last spoke, any news happened around the world that we should talk about?
Gee, I'm scratching my head trying to think of anything at all. Hang on a minute. Yes, there was that little incident in Paris.
That's right, where a bunch of religious terrorists ran amok and just caused mayhem in a beautiful city. So, by the time people listen to this, Paul, they would have heard a fair bit about the topic. So, what can we say? We'll mention a few things from a secular point of view, I guess. Malcolm Turnbull came out with a statement, and he said that it's a threat in the name of God, but is truthfully the work of the devil. So he's drawing from his Old Testament and making analogies. Some of our members got a bit heated about that, but in the heat of the moment, I don't hold a lot against Malcolm Turnbull, especially in relation to that. A bit of devil talk there, not unlike Tony Abbott, really.
I was a bit surprised to hear Malcolm Turnbull say that, and I thought it was a very poorly judged comment, but it might have just been something that slipped out in the heat of the moment, I suppose.
Yeah.
Although it's not the sort of thing I would expect from such a an intelligent, intelligent and on the whole pretty competent sort of person.
I'm hoping he was just looking for colourful language and not thinking too hard about it. So, maybe that's what's happened. All the usual arguments trotted out during the week, of course, where we have people saying that this is the work of extremist part of Islam, and then we've got other people saying that this is not Islam at all because Islam is a religion of peace. Well, my view, Paul, would be, of course, it's a legitimate exercise of Islamic faith because that's exactly what the Quran says they should be doing.
Yes.
But in the end, it doesn't really matter because it's clearly religious and it's, the idea of paradise and God and doing things on earth to get yourself into heaven and whether it is part of Islam or something else, it's a religious act.
I wonder if... I often, when I read these denials of that it's a part of Islam or even any kind of religion, some of the denials are bordering on the absurd, really. Are they coming from ex-members of the Monty Python outfit? I'm not sure, because people are saying the most ridiculous things. They're saying no religion is violent. No religion would ever inspire this kind of act. And it historically, it's just nonsense. Obviously, religion is implicated in a lot of historical violence and obviously continues to be so. Look, I suppose I would accept those who argue that the majority of Muslims, and look, we've discussed this before, that none of us really truly think the majority of Muslims are bad people. Obviously, the majority of Muslims are just people like people everywhere who are trying to get on with their lives and, live and get along with their neighbours and all the rest of it. But I think it's just absurd to say that it's not one aspect of the Islamic religion, because clearly And as you know, studies around the world, I forget the name of the study that was carried out not too long ago, the Pew Research study, I think it was, that showed a very significant minority of Muslims had no problem with violence being perpetrated on those who, for example, insult Islam or insult the Prophet, etc., etc. So clearly there is a section of the Islamic community in the world who are quite sympathetic to violent responses, who are defensive, who are in denial about anything bad their religion might be responsible for, etc., etc.
Yep. So they'll pick and choose.
If I can add one thing, Paul Kelly in The Australian, actually, you may have seen the article, I think it was yesterday, came out and said clearly religion is related to this and to deny it is ridiculous. So there are some fairly substantial public commentators now coming out, and some politicians even, I've noticed, are coming out now and saying, look, we can't just pretend that religion has nothing to do with this.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, but they'll sort of bend over backwards normally to say that Islam isn't the problem, it's a religion of peace, and
that's right.
And, you know, it's this is an attack on Islam as much as an attack on anybody. So, until Islam cleans up its holy book, which is never going to happen, then, the fact of the matter is ISIS and people like them are actually, following the book in fine detail. So, in one sense, to be congratulated for their adherence to their holy book. But I think I read a quote once that said, if in your religion your fundamentalists are a problem, then there must be a problem with the fundamentals of your religion.
Yes, I saw that too. And that resonated with me, I have to say.
Yes. So, I mean, we don't see upset Amish people running around and blowing up people,
Yes. Yes. And I sometimes make a similar point with people when having a discussion on the topic. And I say, look, if the Buddhist Tibetans haven't been oppressed in quite substantial ways by the dominant Chinese, then nobody's been oppressed. I mean, they have been very badly oppressed since the early 1950s when the People's Liberation Army took control of Tibetan territory. And yet you don't see waves of Buddhist suicide bombers blowing up restaurants in Beijing or anywhere else for that matter in China. There have been some attacks by Muslims in China, the Uyghur people from northwest China, who are also arguably under the thumb of the Chinese, the Chinese government, I should say, and some of them have been engaging in violent reactions against Chinese civilians in Beijing, etc. There was a case where a burning car, I think, was rammed into a crowd of people in front of the Forbidden City in Beijing, but you don't see that sort of thing happening with Tibetan Buddhists. If they do make a violent public statement, you generally make it in the form of self-immolation in a public place.
Yes.
So they don't go around murdering innocent civilians. They murder themselves to make a point.
Yes, in some countries, although you've got Myanmar with the Buddhists there who have totally oppressed the Muslim minority, the Rohingyas, and done terrible things to them. So
indeed they have.
That's sort of a government oppression rather than a terrorist act.
Yes, it would appear the government has supported that kind of violence as well.
Yeah, indeed.
The Rohingyas are seen as non-citizens.
Yeah. I think I had the misfortune to watch a bit of Q&A. I couldn't stomach much of it. I sort of got bits of it and, reading the tweets underneath, and, one tweet would say, well, you don't see atheists out, committing terrorism acts. And then another tweet a bit later would give the example of, Nazi Germany or the Shining Path in Peru or people like that. And Well, the point is, they're not doing it in the name of atheism. You know, they just, you know, happen to be atheist, or but they're not doing it in the name of atheism, which is quite different. So,
yes.
So, you know, that's the argument that trots out, and really, of course, they're part of Islam. But God, even if they weren't, it's a religious ideology that's happening here, and yet an example of why they're so dangerous when we allow them to preach.
I think, Trevor, like you, I'm the sort of person that would rather see religion fairly rapidly evaporate from human society, fairly rapidly disappear, but realistically it's not going to happen. So I suppose we probably should be getting on board with those who would like to see the people of Islam reform themselves. And when you say the Quran is never going to change, I don't think we can reliably claim that it will never be changed. I think if we went back to the time of the Spanish Inquisition, we might have had trouble imagining Christianity ever becoming the tame pussycat that it sort of is in most respects now.
Yeah.
True. You know what I mean?
Yes. Well,
we tend to sort of smile at the Catholic priest going about his work now, except for the child molester, of course. But do you know what I mean? I suppose it might sound arrogant and superior, but I look at religious people going about their work now, Christians on the whole, but, you know, the benign ones, the ones that don't do any particular harm except to spread their particular brand of superstitious nonsense. And I suppose I do feel a bit superior to them sometimes in the way that, what's the famous Australian comedian that I'm trying to think of with the red hair, the ranger? Tim Minchin.
Right, yep.
In the way that Tim Minchin sometimes, I've seen some posts on Facebook attributed to him where he says, you know, it's a bit hard not to feel superior and arrogant sometimes when you know you're right.
Yes.
And all those people who say, well, atheism is just another point of view and religion is an equally valid point of view. Well, I don't think it is an equally valid point of view myself, because atheism has a whole lot more evidence in support of its position than any religious position does, to my knowledge.
Yes.
But at the same time, we have to be careful not to act or to appear to be arrogant, because we are engaged in a contest of ideas, and nobody wins a contest of ideas by starting out, you know, by swaggering onto the stage sort of saying, look, at the outset, I just want you all to understand I'm right and you're all wrong, you know.
Yes. Yep.
So I think we do have to bite our lips a little bit sometimes and just, you know, calmly try to argue our position.
Look, I think when people have been indoctrinated, you know, personally, I'm not really interested in trying to change people's opinions about religion in that way. The indoctrinated ones, I'm not interested in converting them to atheism. I'm just more interested in stopping them getting their hands on young kids and indoctrinating another generation. I really couldn't care about converting religious people to atheism. I've sort of... Yeah. You know, if they're going to, they're going to. It's the kids. Yes. We've got to get their hands off them is the ones that motivate me. But but a couple of issues always come out as well is, you know, did the Muslim hierarchy apologise properly? And I've got a quiz here for you, Paul.
Oh, great. I love quizzes.
Yeah. This one's going to be easy for you, I think. Okay?
Oh, okay.
So the Grand
Mufti... Is there a prize?
Just a feeling of smugness and superiority is what I'm offering.
Yeah. Okay.
So the Grand Mufti of Australia, so the head Islamic figure... He said either A or B, okay? So A, he said, in response to Paris, the cold-blooded massacre of 129 innocents in the name of Allah is a wake-up call for the Muslim world to engage in self-examination, global responsibility, and an overriding resolve to end Islamic terror. Okay, that's possibility A. Yeah. Or possibility B was he blamed the Paris attacks on Islamophobia, meaning the French were killed in the name of Islam because they had an irrational fear of Islam. So which one do you reckon it was, A or B?
Having seen this guy interviewed before, I think it was probably B.
Was indeed, yes. So the media statement from the Mufti, 15th of November 2015, these recent incidents highlight, well, okay, he mourns the loss of the innocent lives, conveys deepest condolences to the families, reiterates the sanctity of human life. But then the third paragraph, and the longest. These recent incidents highlight the fact that current strategies to deal with the threat of terrorism are not working. It is therefore imperative that all causative factors such as racism, Islamophobia, curtailing freedoms through securitization, duplicitous foreign policies, and military intervention must be comprehensively addressed. That's the statement from the Mufti, and I'm going to play now for you a clip from Nick Xenophon on Q&A when he said what he had to say about the Mufti's statement. So I'll play that now.
I agree with you. We need to embrace real Muslims, moderates, or however you want to describe them, because that is the solution to this. And that's why the Grand Mufti of Australia, who I know, Professor Ibrahim Abu Muhammad, was unequivocal in his condemnation and expressing his condolences and grief for what occurred in France. And that's Australia's Islamic leader. I think it's very, very encouraging.
So according to Nick Xenophon, that was a full and complete apology by the Mufti.
Well, Nick Xenophon's no fool, and I have to say that I often agree with things Nick Xenophon says. So I'm a little bit surprised that he's being so magnanimous about that.
Yeah, I was surprised as well. So so anyway, that's the Mufti. So gosh, you know, they still need to work on the PR, don't they? Even if you're, you know, if you are a moderate Muslim out there, and that's your Mufti, and he's saying stuff like that, you must be slapping your hand on your forehead and thinking, "What the hell? Can't we do better?" He's the Tony Abbott of the Islamic political scene.
I can't help wondering if some of the more proactive members or leaders of the Muslim community in Australia aren't looking around for a replacement for the Grand Mufti. Is he replaceable, or is it a sort of, you know, president for life type position?
Who knows?
He's a big disappointment, and one wonders how he was selected in the first place. Was it just on the basis of his Islamic studies, because he's a doctor or something in Islamic studies, isn't he? But he's a poor representative for the community. Always has been, in my opinion. I have seen him interviewed before, and he's always interviewed speaking in Arabic. I think he's from Egypt originally.
Right.
He hasn't taken the time or effort to, you know, in about 19 or 20 years, I think he's been in Australia, hasn't made much of an effort to really get with the local language so that he can communicate with Australian Muslims in the language that most of them probably use day to day, which is English. So I think he's a big disappointment. And his public statements are consistently underwhelming, I should say. And you know, I think what you're saying is that the Mufti is just doing the same thing he's always done, which is, you know, blame everybody but the members of his own religion who mess up.
Yep. So, I mean,
it's blame the West, isn't it? Blame the West.
It is.
Not the Muslims. They're just doing the right thing as they always have done, and it's all the West's fault.
You know, what we've got is a perceived grievance by these people. We've got a situation where they don't identify with their local community. They feel that they don't fit in, and then with that, you know, religion and Islam is like throwing kerosene onto smouldering sort of embers, and poof, up it goes.
Up it goes.
And it's this integration that has to happen of young Muslims, where they have to, integrate with the rest of society. But of course, the Quran says not to. You're not supposed to associate with infidels. So, of course, they don't feel part of society and suffer as a result. And
yes,
then,
indeed.
And then religion provides the fuel to the fire. So
yes, and there was that case last week, Trevor, of the is it Hizbut al-Tahrir, or I'm not sure how to say the name, but it's a fairly radical Islamic group in Australia who have been banned in some countries, but not in Australia. And look, I think quite rightly not banned here, because better that they speak publicly and we know what they're on about and we know what their ideas are and what their agenda is.
Right.
But they've, they've come out again and said that, why should they be integrated? You know, why don't they have the same rights as all Australians to live their lives as they feel that they wish to, or as they see fit?
Yes.
And I suppose the, you know, the multiculturalists who, you know, what I would probably call the naive multiculturalists would probably come out and support their view on the surface of it, you know, that people shouldn't be forced to integrate.
Yes.
But I think, unfortunately, that is not going to work. I think a so-called multicultural society can be a functioning reality so long as people do have certain values in common, or they do accept certain base principles to make the society work. In other words, to keep the society at peace and in harmony. And I think a degree of integration is absolutely essential myself. And I think if we look at Australia's case, over the years, since the Second World War in particular, when we've had several waves of mass migration to Australia, they've virtually all integrated, haven't they? And that's probably why Australia has been, up until recently, a very peaceful and non-violent society on the whole.
Yep.
So I think those people have to be called out and have to be confronted with those sorts of ideas. I think it is absolutely essential that people integrate. Now, on that note, and I mentioned to you a little earlier, there was a very interesting study coming out of Denmark.
Yes.
And it says, the title of the article, it's by Andrew McIntyre.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called, the title is, In Denmark, A Bruising Multiculturalism.
Yep.
And I'll just read the lead-in for that article. It says, the statistic is shocking. Some 70% of Danish youths in detention are Muslim. A psychologist, Nikolai Senels, learned when he set out to discover why. The reasons have much to do with an insular community's disdain for what, other than welfare payments, a modern and liberal Western nation represents. And it goes on to explain that this person, a clinical psychologist working with youth in prisons in Copenhagen, he went in and he actually studied the attitudes of young people who were in trouble with the law, both Muslim and non-Muslim. And here's what he found. He found that young Muslims tend to react with anger and hostility towards being called out, you know, being reprimanded or being told that what they're doing is not good. Whereas in the West, so anyway, it makes a comparison between the responses of Muslim youth and non-Muslim youth. Sorry, Trevor, you wanted to say something there?
What he was saying was that in the West, you know, threatening expressions of anger would be to lose face as a sign of weakness, as if you lose your temper and showing anger. Whereas amongst the Muslims, he found that anger was not only accepted, it was seen as a sign of strength. And
that's
indeed,
right.
Anger in itself is regarded as an argument. So, so the approach to anger was very different in the cultures. And the second difference he found was about honour versus security. And he said that Westerners mostly regard criticism as, while perhaps unpleasant, an honourable thing when offered honestly and on its merits.
And something that could be constructive.
Yes, whereas in Islam and Muslim culture, criticism is seen as an attack on one's honour. So very different approaches to honour and security. And did you want to go for the third and fourth? Well, you got that in front of you?
No, you go right ahead. You're on a roll.
Oh, okay. So then there was this victimhood versus self-responsibility. In Western societies, people see their lives as a result of their own choices, whereas within Islam, all of life is the will of Allah. Yes. And the daily lives of Muslim is governed by Sharia, cultural traditions, and male family members. So an experience of being controlled, where personal wishes, democratic impulses, and individual choices are disregarded and even punished. So, and then finally, the fourth sort of factor that he identified as differences was tolerance. Westerners are taught that tolerance is both good in itself and a defining characteristic of a decent citizen. Whereas within Islam, intolerance of non-Muslims, members of sexual minorities, women, non-Islamic authorities, and secular laws is expected. So, while we're expected to be tolerant, they are expected to be intolerant.
Yes, which explains a lot, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. So
it explains a lot of the responses we get, where Muslims demand tolerance from non-Muslims, but don't feel that they should be extending the same level of tolerance.
Yeah, so he did 10 years of really in-depth research comparing Muslims and non-Muslims, and basically, among his Muslim clients, a mere handful thought of themselves as Danish. Most saw themselves as Moroccans, Somalis, Pakistanis, etc., who happened to be living in another country.
And I think it's worth mentioning, sorry to interrupt, I think it's worth mentioning that this was not a small group of people. There were something like 45,000 teenagers of both Muslim and non-Muslim origin interviewed for this study. So this is not a tiny little anecdotal type of study at all. It's quite a serious piece of work.
Yes. So what else do we have here that I got highlighted? He said immigrants need three things in order to integrate. They must want to be part of the host society, they must be allowed to join that society, and they need to have the capacity to do so. And very few Muslim immigrants meet all three criteria.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. So, you know, the beauty of all this, 12th man, is that we're really carping on about Muslims here, and we could be accused of Islamophobia, except over the last 20 episodes, we've had a go at everybody. So, it's just not Muslims.
I don't know about you, Trevor, but I find this concept of Islamophobia itself a problematic concept. I don't feel that I'm an Islamophobe in any way, shape, or form. I certainly have some major concerns about Islam. Phobia is a fear, of course. I'm certainly very concerned about the potential harm that can be inflicted on others by people professing the Muslim faith. So, it's not altogether an irrational fear anyway, is it?
Yes. Well, I like the fact that our Mufti blamed the attacks on Islamophobia.
Yes, interesting.
Which, the French were killed in the name of Islam because they had an irrational fear of Islam, like, for goodness sake. So
it's just borders on the absurd, doesn't it?
So, of course, on social media, you would have seen the hashtag #PrayForParis. Paul, did you use that hashtag yourself?
I didn't, and I think you understand why. I'm not one who sees prayer as of much use for anything to anyone, except for those doing the praying who might feel a little bit of psychological comfort from doing it. But
well, one would wonder why, because, God clearly sat by and allowed all of that to happen.
If there is a God.
If there is a God, indeed. So why pray to such a God now if he allowed that to just happen and he could, with the click of his fingers, have stopped it at any time? So
I suppose you have to decide whose God are you praying to? Are they the same God? And is he a little bit confused about his priorities?
Yes. So, it's classic, our thoughts and prayers are with, you know, blah, blah. Like, you just see that all the time. And, you know, it's probably people don't really think of it as prayers quite often when they say that. It's
It's become a set phrase.
Yes, it has.
That people use in those sorts of moments.
It has, and that's the shame. But I posted on our Secular Party Facebook page a thing from the Charlie Hebdo cartoonist Jean Savard, who did a little cartoon with a guy with a sort of speech bubble above him, and it says, "Friends from the whole world, thank you for your hashtag pray for Paris, but we don't need more religion. Our faith goes to music, kisses, life, champagne and joy. Hashtag Paris is about life." So I like that. Yeah. We don't need more religion, because that's clearly what's got them into that position in the first place. So
yes,
I really like that, and the fact that it came from the Charlie.
There's a delicious irony in the whole thing, isn't there? Really?
Yes. So the fact that it came from a Charlie Hebdo cartoonist meant that you could do that, and then nobody could criticise him for that. So, what else have we got on this topic? I think we might move on a little bit. I'll just briefly divert to Syria. I mean, this is part of the cause of the problem. And as you know, Paul, after the United States, we are the most active participant in Syria in terms of military stuff that we're doing.
So they keep telling us, our politicians keep reminding us that we're the second biggest contributor.
Yes. So when the world leaders
gather... Why do you think they do that?
Well, when the world leaders gather together, you know, Vladimir Putin and Obama and other, you know, bigwigs of the world stage to discuss Syria... Wouldn't you think that our involvement as the second most active player would get us a seat at the table? No, apparently not.
Apparently not.
So, Putin said, well, we only want major powers or people in the region to be involved in these negotiations, so we don't want Australia there. So...
I think Putin's still a little bit miffed about us complaining about the Russian missile shooting down the passenger plane.
Yes, it could well be, and Tony Abbott's threatening to shirt front him or whatever, and he just, you know, exercised a little power and just said to the United States, well, we don't want Australia there. And, of course, the United States said, oh, Australia, too bad, you're not coming to the meeting,
look,
you know.
And yeah, just wait for us in the other room, please, Australia.
Exactly. So with all of that, and we can't even get a seat at the table when the discussions about Syria are going on.
Yes.
At that
and
point,
we wear it.
At that point,
our politicians wear it.
Yes. You know? Nobody says anything. Can't we just pick up our bat and ball and go home now?
Surely. Say, pick up our F-18s and say, well, you know, if we can't be part of the committee that picks the umpires, then
if we're
going home.
If we're not part of the solution discussions here, then why would we be doing what we're doing? Let's see you later. We're off. And would anybody blame us? I just think that's what we should be doing.
I think we should too.
Yeah. So anyway, I thought that was interesting. We couldn't even get a seat there. Meanwhile, we're considering. This is the other thing. Is apparently, Paul, we're considering sending peacekeepers to Syria.
Yeah.
What do you reckon peacekeeper means?
And what does it mean in that context? Yes, it means sending somebody in to try and do as little as possible and not get hurt in the process.
Wasn't there a famous rifle or a handgun in the US called the Peacekeeper or something like that?
That's interesting. Yeah.
I'm sure there was, but you know, rather than we're going to be sending more troops or we're sending special forces, we're sending peacekeepers.
Yeah.
I got a feeling they'll have guns and flak jackets and helmets and be, you know, authorising strikes, but let's call them peacekeepers.
Do you recall several months ago there were a group of, I think, Fijian peacekeepers that were taken prisoner by one of the one of the militant groups in southern Syria.
No, I didn't see that. Fijian peacekeepers, right.
I think so. Yeah, it was. I think it was a few months ago now. But they were finally freed or released or a combination of the above. There were several groups that were attacked and I think some of them even captured by some. I don't think they were ISIS, but they were one of the groups fighting against Assad in Syria.
Right.
But they were released. But clearly peacekeepers are not respected too much in that part of the world at the moment.
No.
And I'm not sure if there's any real purpose in having them there.
Well, anyway, we'll move on from Syria. And I keep trying to find quizzes for you, Paul.
Oh, good. So, yeah, thank you.
But I think I sent you this link, so you probably read it already anyway. But there's this ambassador in the Middle East, and he said that he's been involved in stopping naval vessels and sort of taking out sort of pirate-like activities, his country. And he said that their right to do so was founded on the laws of the Prophet, that it was written in their Quran that all nations who should not have answered their authority were sinners, that it was their right and duty to make war upon them wherever they could be found, and to make slaves of all they could take as prisoners, and that every Muslim who should be slain in battle was sure to go to paradise. So this was a ambassador defending his country's role in attacking naval vessels and other merchant ships. So, Paul, did you read that article?
I'm not sure, Trevor.
Right.
Sorry, who was the ambassador of which country?
Well, here's my question for you. When do you think that statement was made?
Oh, that was the one. Was that the one in the Mediterranean?
Yes.
Algeria or some place like that, or Libya.
This is,
and that was going back to the late 19th century, I think.
It was 1786.
Oh, wow.
So this is when Thomas Jefferson was the US ambassador to France. And all of these ships are getting attacked by these pirates. And Jefferson met with Tripoli's envoy and said, "What are you doing? Like, we're peaceful people. We're just trying to conduct trade here." And the ambassador said, "Well, according to the Prophet, this is what we're supposed to be doing." And
That's right,
and so Jefferson was trying to strike a deal with him to stop them from attacking all of these ships. And thousands of American and European trade ships entering the Mediterranean had been targeted by these pirates.
Yeah.
So the point of that, Paul, is that this has been going on for a long time, and this is well before any American intervention in, you know, the oil states and the things that were going on then. So while some people say, you know, it's all because we've gone into their countries, taken their oil, rewritten the boundaries, and that's why this is all happening, the answer is yes, that has not helped, and that's a large contributor to it. But also, according to their religion, they're supposed to be doing raping and pillaging and killing of infidels, and they've been believing that, you know, in 1786, according to Thomas Jefferson. So yeah, all that didn't help, but it's already been a mess well before then as well. So I've always found that one to be interesting.
Yeah. Look, it takes me back to the old issue of, are we allowed to criticize another culture? And of course the multiculturalists would jump up and down and say, no, you can't criticize their culture, that's offensive, it's unfair, it's rude, they're entitled to have their own culture, etc., etc. But I think if we're going to make any progress on this problem, we need to be honest and very frank and open. And I think I often say to people, well, slavery used to be a cultural tradition for a lot more people than it is now, including Europeans. And at some point, people decided that was a tradition that we didn't need to perpetuate, and that, in fact, was harmful, and we were better off without it. The same thing happened in China with foot binding of young girls and women in order to make them more sexually attractive. At some point, people realized that was an oppressive practice and they abandoned it. Now, surely we're entitled to criticize other cultures. And look, you know, having said that, I think there's a lot well, maybe not a lot, but there are certainly things about our current Australian culture that are, you know, open to valid criticism as well. And why not, you know? But at the same time, we shouldn't feel too reticent to criticise the cultural practices of people who come to live in this country and become Australians eventually. So,
yep.
You know,
it might have been that Islam might have gone through a reformation in the last 50 or 100 years had we not interfered in that part of the world and toppled legitimate governments and, you know, allocated oil profits to you know.
It's, do you think?
Well, it is possible. I mean, Mossadegh in Iran before the Shah of Iran was conducting a great little country there at one stage, but
except for his oppressive practices via in relation to dissidents, because he was quite violent towards anyone who opposed his government.
Yeah, quite possibly. I don't know all the details, but you know, he was putting the country in the right direction, and it just simply the Americans were fearful that he was, you know, some sort of communist type character and all the rest of it. And of course, once the Americans fear that, then you're in real trouble. So, so you know, who knows? Certainly, the interference by Western countries didn't help. But as I said, there's a whole hodgepodge of reasons, isn't there? And what a mess we're in now. So, I've got a link here on the website, ISIS in 5 charts, and interesting, the first chart, 12th man, is it talks about foreign fighters in Syria from distant countries, so not from neighbouring countries, but from distant countries, and
yeah.
Which countries have supplied the most foreign fighters, and we've got France, Britain, Germany, Australia, Belgium, Netherlands, Denmark, United States, Austria, Norway, Ireland, Sweden, and Australia's fourth on that list. France had the most with...
What did you say? It's fourth?
Fourth, yes. So we've supplied the fourth most number of foreign fighters in Syria out of a list like that. So we've provided 250, and somewhere like the United States has only provided 70. So,
well, do you know, it reminds me of the old... phrase, we're punching above our weight.
Yes, unfortunately, yet again. So so meanwhile, in neighboring countries, places like Tunisia provides 3,000, Saudi Arabia 2,500. So and there's a bunch of other charts there, but that was the most interesting one. I thought was that Australia, with our population, is providing an enormous number of fighters.
And how many Muslim people who identify as Muslim do we have in Australia, Trevor? Do you have any idea? I thought it was only in the order of maybe 500,000 or so, isn't it?
500,000 or so? I would have thought, yeah, something like that. It's not a huge number. So I don't know exactly. You've got me without notice there, Paul, but... given our population and relatively small numbers, that to me was a big number of foreign fighters that we've produced. But since we insist on being involved in wars all over the place, it probably shouldn't be that surprising.
Yeah. Look, you know, while I prefer peace, I'm not the sort of person who thinks, you know, peace at any price.
Hmm.
We've seen what results from that sort of attitude with the Second World War. So
yes. So so I reckon we've probably had about 40 minutes of Islam bashing there, which will be enough for the moment. I think we need to move on to some other sacred cows, should I say.
Okay.
12th man. And the Hindus in India, they're up to mischief at the moment. They've got a leader who's fairly right-wing in his views on certain issues. And
And he's a Hindu nationalist,
or
so he's described anyway.
Yes. So we've got Hindu mobs in India are attacking people for the heinous crime, Paul, of eating beef.
Yeah.
So you saw that article?
No, I didn't, but this sort of thing happens from time to time. It's not exactly new.
Yes. So a family attacked in a village outside Delhi by a Hindu mob that suspected the family of eating beef, an accusation the family denied. Another mob killed a truck driver accused of attempting to smuggle cattle to a slaughterhouse, and various other instances. And these are well-educated Indian Hindus who are conducting these attacks. And one of the leaders called Jangir said, "My heart beats only for my dear cow mother." And because he had no sympathy for beef eaters and no qualms about dispensing rough justice. And he said, anyone who eats cow meat should be handed the death sentence. And meanwhile, another vigilante, Manoj Jagir, who has a degree in political administration, tries to justify the violence against the beef eaters by noting, "Our Hindu scriptures say 330 million gods and goddesses reside in one cow." Did you know that? 330 million?
You wouldn't think there'd be enough space inside one cow.
I wouldn't think there'd be that much bacteria, let alone gods and goddesses.
Yeah. Look, I was surprised a few years ago when I travelled to Nepal that it is a jailable offence to kill a cow in Nepal as well. Yeah. I mean, the Nepalese population, I think, is roughly maybe 90% Hindu, which surprised me. I thought there'd be a lot more, a higher proportion of Buddhists. But, it's a jailable offence there as well.
Yep.
So not a lot new there, but to have educated people referring to these sacred texts, these ancient sacred texts, is a bit of a worry, isn't it?
It's just not surprising. So some areas of India are worse than others. So if you do go to India, just be careful and find out what the local beef eating custom is in your particular area. Because
Do you suspect it's the Muslim members of the community that actually do the slaughtering and processing of cows? Well, because the Hindus wouldn't be involved in that sort of industry.
Indeed.
In fact, I saw a short piece on television this afternoon about a man who buys the fat around the kidneys and internal organs from slaughtered cattle and processes the fat and then sells it to cosmetic manufacturers.
Right.
And at the end of it showed him working very hard in very hot, unpleasant conditions, boiling these vats of fat.
Mm.
And then at the end of the program, after he'd, finished work and washed up and gone home, he was dressed in clothing that, to me, looked like he was a Muslim.
Right. That would make sense. Muslims and Christians would be responsible for that in India. That would make sense.
Yes.
So that's going on. And their current president is a bit of a hardliner on that sort of issue. So could get worse in India for beef eaters. We mentioned before Buddhism, and you were saying how they don't necessarily engage in terrorism. And I sort of pointed out, in Myanmar, there's a sort of a state-sanctioned oppression of minority groups by Buddhists. And I have an article here by this guy who sort of, it's called The Truth About Tibetan Buddhism, and he sort of travelled to Tibet hoping to experience a sort of classical version of Buddhism and got quite a shock by the reality of it. So one of the things he said was, because he was expecting a sort of a Dalai Lama, Richard Gere type love-in, and
yes.
He said, "The reality couldn't be more different. The first devout Buddhist I encountered looked neither healthy nor happy. They were walking from their villages in southern Tibet to a temple in Lhasa, Tibetan Buddhism's holiest site. And the journey had taken them nearly 3 months, which isn't surprising considering that with every third or fourth step they took, they got down on their knees and then fully prostrated themselves on the ground, lying flat on their bellies and burying their face in the dirt, before getting back up, taking a few more steps, and doing the same thing again." Have you heard of this?
Yes, indeed. And look, I don't know in great detail very much about Tibetan culture pre the Chinese invasion, but apparently, the little I know tells me that most of the people lived in dire poverty, and that there was a small elite who were basically, you know, like the elite of just about every society in the world, who lived relatively well, and while most people lived in, you know, dire squalor.
Yes.
And the monks live a relatively comfortable life. So that was probably a good career choice for people in Tibet, to become a monk,
right,
so that they wouldn't have to have a really dreadful life. And I had a lecturer in politics at university who was a China specialist. And I recall there was one lecture where he covered the topic of should the occupation of Tibet by the communist Chinese be considered a good thing or a bad thing. And he, at the end of the lecture, he said, well, look, on balance, he thought personally that the Tibetans were better off with the Chinese than without them, simply because the Chinese had introduced, you know, universal education.
Right.
I'm not sure if they've actually applied it evenly to the Tibetans themselves.
Right.
Because I've also seen programs that purported to show what were like, not exactly concentration camps, but certainly camps built to encourage nomadic herding Tibetans to settle down in one place and stop wandering around and occupying the countryside.
Right.
But in fact, they inevitably became slums, you know. They inevitably became just places where people existed rather than lived full, enriching lives. But as I was saying, this lecturer, he came out at the end and he said, look, on balance, he thinks the dire poverty and squalor and inequity, social inequity that existed prior to the Chinese invasion,
yep,
could serve as some sort of justification for the introduction of and let's face it, the Chinese government, even though it is communist and in many ways quite oppressive, it is in fact a secular society. It's a secular government of sorts.
Yes.
Not the sort that I would choose, but it is a secular government rather than one based on religion. But, you know, he came out in favour of the Chinese occupation, although he did concede that the Chinese haven't been very even-handed or even very nice about the way they treat the Tibetans often.
Yeah, well, I think you're in a dire strait if being taken over by communist China is actually an improvement. So that's,
yes,
that's not good. But in this article, this fellow who's sort of on this bit of a journey, he gets to a temple and he excitedly lined up an interview with one of the monks and asked the monk if he's looking forward to the day when the Dalai Lama returns from exile in northern India. And this monk patiently told him, dumb Westerner that he was, that he doesn't worship the Dalai Lama because he's a member of the Nyingmai school of Tibetan Buddhism, while the Dalai Lama is head of the Gelug school. Then there's the, yeah, Kagyu school and the Sakya school, making four in total,
yeah,
which have hot-headed disagreements and have even come to blows in recent years over which deity should be worshipped and which should not.
Yeah.
Another religion of peace for you there, Paul.
Yeah.
A fellow, but
it's certainly more peaceful than some others we could mention.
Well, you know, maybe they're an example. Bernard Faure of Columbia University says, like most clerical discourses, Buddhism is relentlessly misogynist. So while Tibetan women can become nuns, they can't advance nearly as far as men, because according to Buddhist teachings, it is impossible for women to become the perfectly, rightfully enlightened one.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and so I think it just goes to show that, you know, you can have a misogynistic, oppressive sort of religion without terrorizing people. Islam, see, yeah, you can do it. It's possible.
Yeah. Look, I dare say the Buddhists, the nominal Buddhists in Myanmar that are terrorizing the Rohingya Muslims, you know, like people everywhere, probably their religion is just one aspect of what motivates them in life, you know, and there are others. And I suspect that for those people, the Rohingyas are seen as, you know, resource thieves or, you know, just undesirables that have been there far too long and they'd like to see them gone. And I don't think their Buddhist religion isn't any kind of impediment on them acting like the tribalistic humans that most people still are in the world, and you know, acting out of tribal loyalties and tribal resentments, and becoming violent and unpleasant.
Yep. So, rant against Islam, check. Rant against Buddhism, tick.
Check. Hinduism, we've sort of ranted a little bit about Hinduism.
We have. Next on the list, I mean, we haven't gone for the Mormons for a while, so,
could we?
That's the thing about this sort of podcast. We're like a kid in, you open the internet up and you're like a kid in a lolly shop. You know, the number of things that you have a go at, you're just surrounded
by. Let's face it, religion is the gift that keeps on giving to an atheist, because there's just so much ridiculous stuff that comes from it.
Yes.
And I think you're leading into that article mentioning the mass resignation of Mormons in Utah, aren't
yes,
you?
Because there's a new Mormon policy that makes apostates of married same-sex couples and bars their children from certain rights. So, so that policy was only recently revealed, and as a result, a lot of Mormons got up in arms and decided they'd have enough of being a Mormon, and they had this day where thousands of Mormons assembled at the church there in Salt Lake City and submitted their official resignation letters.
It was, if I recall, it was in the order of about 2,000 to 3,000 people, wasn't
it? Yes, 2,500 in attendance. Yeah. Announcing their plans to quit in the wake of the church's bigoted stance towards gay couple and their children. So that's interesting. Of all the crazy things that go on in the Mormon church that people will happily go along with, and then a policy that discriminates against gay couples, and that's the one that triggers 2,500 people to resign, Paul. Is that?
Yeah.
It's an unusual trigger, isn't it? Given it's, some of the other many other things you could complain about.
It's an unusual outcome to me. I wouldn't have thought there'd be 2,500 Mormons that felt so strongly about that issue that they would make such a public demonstration of it.
Yeah, so it just goes to show that that issue of gay rights can be used to get people to resign from a church. So
yes, it is very interesting.
Yeah, maybe we need to organise a mass resignation rally in Brisbane, for example, Paul, where we could say to people of the Catholic faith, are you unhappy with these Catholic Church's position on gay people? I mean, 2,500 Mormons resigned over this issue. Yeah. Are you prepared to resign and come and bring your resignation letter to this spot? What do you reckon?
I sometimes get into conversations with practicing, or I would call them nominal Catholics. A lot of the people I come across in my work are from Latin America, and a lot of them are nominal Catholics, and some are even quite actively practicing Catholics. Now, when the subject comes up of the new Pope, most people have a very positive impression of him and tend to praise him and say, well, he's different to the other guys and he's doing a really good job and we should be supporting him. And I say, well, yeah, maybe. What about the fact that he hasn't changed the Catholic Church's policy on condoms, and that there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people who are going to die a horrible death from AIDS or some other sexually transmitted disease because they've been told that to use a condom is a sinful practice and they must never do it under any circumstances. And, I get interesting responses. People go, it never occurred to me. I didn't think of that. But there's a lot that we could raise as reasons for resignation, I think.
Yeah, well, I made the point in a very early podcast. Actually, it was episode 1 when it was resurrected, I think. That you know, I had a birth certificate and a confirmation certificate, a baptism certificate, and but you know, clearly no longer a practicing Catholic, I needed some certificate to show that, and
to show your resignation.
Yeah, and there's no way the Catholic Church would issue me with a divorce certificate from the Catholic Church. Oh, so yeah. So on the Iron Fist Velvet Glove website, I do have a little link there, Paul, and allowing people to answer a couple of simple questions, and it will generate a little certificate for you to confirm your renunciation from the Catholic Church.
So, that's very, very good idea.
But a public service that we offer here.
Yes.
Paul, so were you a Catholic? What were you brought up?
No, I was brought up in the Church of England.
Right, okay. So,
and it was a fairly... It wasn't High Church of England. It was just your average bread-and-butter Church of England. My mother sent me to church and my sisters to church. I think, you know, my mother was not a particularly well-educated person. I think she did it out of a sense of social obligation, you know, that it was the right thing to do to send your children to church.
Yes.
So I went to Sunday school for many years, in fact, and later returned in my mid-teens for confirmation. So, yes, I've been confirmed into the Church of England.
Yes.
So I'm a fully-fledged member. So I feel I have a right to voice an opinion. I mean, I would anyway, of course.
But yes. Well, it's a fairly simple form that I have asked people to complete here. They put in their name and their email address and ask them to confirm to the Catholic Church that they seek renunciation from. And the first question is, do you solemnly and sincerely declare that you hereby divorce yourself from the Catholic Church? It's a simple yes and no answer. Do you promise to never again eat the body or drink the blood of Jesus Christ? It's a simple yes and no answer there.
Yeah.
And... here at the Iron Fist Velvet Glove Religious Renunciation Service Centre, we recognise that sometimes to be polite or to show your respects, you may be required to attend a Catholic wedding or funeral. During these ceremonies, the priest may say verses, hoping to receive traditional verbal responses. To be polite, it may be difficult to appear to say nothing. In such circumstances, do you promise to say Raman rather than Amen? And a simple yes or no. If you get those questions right... and click the button, you get yourself a Catholic Church renunciation certificate. So,
oh wow! So, are you distributing the certificate?
Yeah, well, it'll generate it and print it as a little PDF. It'll pop up for you, and you can print it yourself. Paul,
can you change the Catholic Church part to you know fit any particular?
I can
church?
If you can provide me with a couple of questions for other churches, then we can do a separate one. Yeah, so
terrific.
So we might organise that in conjunction with I'd love the idea of advertising a gathering of people who wanted to quit their church, just like these Mormons have done, based on its attitude to gay rights, and see what response we could get. So
perhaps you should put up, Trevor, a list of pretty good reasons for resigning from the church, because from my experience, and I dare say you've had similar experiences, a lot of people who profess to be members of a religion often don't have a very detailed knowledge of their religion. And I mentioned dealing in my work with people from Latin America who are often Catholics, and you know, I sometimes mention things on like, did you know that nuns are officially married to Jesus? And they go, what?
I didn't. You know? What? Nuns are officially... No. In which church?
I'm not making this
in
up.
In which church?
Yeah, Catholic nuns, Roman Catholic nuns. Didn't you see the Australian series of several years ago called Brides of Christ?
I saw bits of it, maybe, but I know the series you mean. And in that, they're saying that as a nun, you are accepting the proposition that you're married to Christ.
To Jesus Christ, that's right. And they actually look, I don't know if they still do the ceremony. I'm assuming they do, but I don't really know. The nuns, when they take their, before they take their vows, or as one of the rituals they go through, they dress in a white wedding dress.
Is that right?
And they go to church and the priest marries them to Jesus.
Wow.
Now, obviously, Jesus is some sort of raging bigamist, because he has a lot of brides. over the years. He's had quite a few of them.
He's got a complicated family tree.
And you know, the imagination is running a bit rampant here. How, in fact, if at all, does he consummate all those marriages?
I'm not even going to try and think about it. So goodness me. Well, I didn't know that one. So that's news to me.
It might be an area that we would be worth investigating in a bit more detail. Yeah. Does the Catholic Church still go through with that sort of ritual? I have no idea. I don't think they have a lot of young women lining up to become nuns these days either, do they? The average age, I think, is around in the late 60s or early 70s now, the average age of nuns in Australia, I think.
Mm. Yeah, well, for the Mormons, just the simple gay rights issue was enough for 2,500 to resign in one day in a big ceremony, you know, maybe you don't have to explain too much other than a couple of facts about the Catholic Church attitude to, you know, gay rights and birth control, perhaps, be enough. So,
Look,
who knows?
You know, as you were saying earlier, if we can prevent the indoctrination of children, I think we're a long way there towards achieving a truly enlightened and certainly more secular world. What was I going to say? I think education is an extremely powerful tool. Some people won't change their minds no matter how much evidence you put in front of them. Mm. But I have seen cases of ex-Mormons publicly explaining that they lost their religion after reading some of the published histories of their founder, Joseph Smith, who was a convicted fraudster. You know, there are published histories out there. Most people will just avert their eyes and say, no, that can't be true, or somebody's just defaming the religion. But, you know, there are Mormons out there, of course, intelligent Mormons, who do check out the details of their religion and find it wanting. If only we could encourage more people to do the same about whatever religion they subscribe to.
Yes, yeah. One of the interesting anecdotes about the Mormon Church was that their founder had this Egyptian papyrus with sort of writing on it, and he had created this dictionary which purported to interpret that papyrus and had all this religious connotation to it as a result. And subsequently, though, they discovered the Rosetta Stone, which was like an official dictionary of the language, and they could quite easily then read this hieroglyphics. And, of course, it had absolutely nothing to do with what he had written. It was a complete and utter fabrication.
An utter fabrication, and also people who study text, you know, text scholars, have studied the Book of Mormon, and they, you know, they basically say the Book of Mormon was written in a kind of faux, you know, the way the original Common Bible was written. What was the King James Version? In that kind of, would it have been 17th century
English? It was a put-on, it would be like if you and I started speaking like a Shakespearean play. It was just, it adopted in a very false sense this olden style language to try and
To give it a bit of cachet, I suppose.
Yes, which was shown again to be a complete sort of put-on. So.
Yeah, and his claims, of course, about the Native Americans being one of the tribes of Israel. I mean, geneticists have put paid to that theory, well and truly. And they found that, no, they didn't come from the Middle East. They came from East Asia.
Yeah. I'm surprised at how well the Mormon Church seems to get around in Australia. You do sort of come across a few Mormons. And on the sporting field, there's, you know, rugby league has its fair share of Mormons, and they go off and do their little 2 years, take a break from rugby league and come back and... It's amazing how much traction they've got.
It's got quite a bit of traction in some of the South Pacific countries as well.
Well, these would tend to be South Pacific sort of heritage footballers that I'm thinking of in my mind. So, so, there you go. People will swallow anything. But
Basically, they will, Trevor. Basically, they will. Yep. And people will believe whatever they want to believe at the end of the day, won't they? And I think, personally, again, getting back to education, I think it's because most people don't have a good comprehensive education about the history of the world, the history and the evolution of human societies, etc., etc. And so they just don't have the critical skills to unpick this sort of nonsense that they're fed by somebody offering them some form of emotional comfort or social solidarity and inclusion, which usually goes with the religion, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, when I said people will swallow anything, I actually made a mistake there, because the Iranian president will not swallow a sip of wine at all, and in fact doesn't want to watch anybody else sip their wine. So,
no, he doesn't want any at the same table.
So what I'm referring to here is an article from the 10th of November where they're trying to set up a meeting between France and Iran, and you know, with most meetings of these types, you'd have a meal of some sort, and the Iranian leader refused to be involved in a dinner where wine would be served. And good on the French, because they said, Paul, they refused to be at a dinner where wine is not served.
Yeah, I thought that was good too. And in fact, it shows the double standard that a lot of Muslims have with tolerance. You know, they say that they have to be tolerated, but they don't have to tolerate anybody else.
Yes. So, yeah, exactly. It's this religious freedom notion. Well, you're free. Don't drink the wine if you don't want to. Just don't object if somebody else wants to. It's so simple, but this is the heart of world problems, Paul. But the French offered an alcohol-free breakfast, but the Iranians rejected that as a bit too cheap. So
And look, you know, I'm a great fan of French croissants and strong coffee, so I think the French breakfast would have been fabulous.
Yes.
I would have taken
that. So they missed out there, but so that's our last swipe at final swipe at Islam. Now, we've had some correspondence from a listener, Paul.
Terrific.
Yes, our listener Doug is keen to get hold of the Ten Commandments from the humanist point of view that you came up with last week. So I need you to send me the link, and we'll put that link on last week's show notes so people can get that. So Doug, that will be there. And
there are actually several, I think, non-religious Ten Commandments.
Yeah, maybe the one that you were looking at.
Bertrand Russell wrote one. Mm-hmm. I think Christopher Hitchens wrote one.
Right.
I'm not sure if it was very different, but yeah, there are a number, so we can certainly provide those fairly easily to people.
Yeah, so we'll put that on there. And Doug, thank you for the correspondence. That was nice to know that there's at least one person out there listening. And Paul, we're going to finish off. We normally have a piece of music called A Certain Sadness, but Malcolm Turnbull said that in the football stadium after the incident there in Paris, as the people were leaving the stadium, they were singing the national anthem of France. And as we sign off tonight, I'm going to be playing a bit of that. And if that doesn't stir the blood and put a little tear in the corner of your eye and just make you feel a bit special, and
then you have a heart of stone.
Exactly. So, so listeners, sit back and enjoy a bit of the French national anthem, and we will catch up with you next week. Bye for now.
Bye, listeners.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It just, it'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.